Pierce, Frank, Sharp, Kelly, and Rieger and Fertula. It's 1:17 in the afternoon. It's the 5th of May. First, we have Senate Bill 124. There's a draft CS being handed out as we speak. It's the Kramer J version dated 5-4. Senator Sharp, would you move the work draft?
Madam Chair, I move the work draft for CS 124.
And there's a motion to adopt the work draft. Is anyone opposed to that? Senator Sharp, can you please explain it to us?
Madam Chair, this would provide a vehicle to establish a task force to evaluate the how to go about phasing out in a regimented manner AEA, and to come up with recommendations to the legislature on how to best do that so that we don't leave any irons in the fire that has to be there to facilitate AEA programs under the Constitution. Which we've had several reports on, that the bonding is a very serious matter, and we'll have to examine it closely. This would allow that to be done between now and December.
Are there any questions for Senator Sharp? That's the will of the committee.
I have one question.
Senator Petula.
Since we're organized on a party structured line, I don't see any place necessarily for, and I'm reading as I'm talking, so I may be wrong, for any member of the minority of the nine to be selected, no direction toward that. I think there is a lot of knowledge and certainly a responsibility to acknowledge members of the minority in the decision-making effort such as this. I'm not saying it wouldn't happen anyway, but it might not.
I would have no problem with accommodating that if that is an issue.
I don't know it is, Senator.
Senator Frank?
Perhaps at the risk of further expansion by two members, we could increase the on line 7, parentheses 3, we could say two members of the House and two members of the Senate, so that the President and the Speaker, at their discretion, would have the opportunity to keep involved the people within the majorities that have participated in this, but at the same time allow for minority participation.
That's still well,
Senator, Ms. Senator Frank, why couldn't we just say in the subsection 3 that the members of the House and the member of the Senate selected by the appropriate presiding officer be of the party other than 1 and 2 or something? You've already got 4 legislative members.
Well, I think that's true, except that I think that it may be that the Speaker of the House is the person that's most interested in the issue on their side. I would say that frankly Senator Sharp is the one that's most interested in our house.
It can be a designee in line 2.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I have any objection to the ones you mentioned as being members, but I think our caucus will think that, and I think there's some truth in that.
Yeah. I think we should provide for it in some fashion.
Well,
in line 3, you just make it a minority member of each caucus. I mean, a minority member of each house.
Madam Chair.
Senator Kelly.
I might be prepared to accept that amendment if we have some assurance that it wasn't going to take us 3 days to get this through the Senate.
Chairperson, I have very little to say about the length of time it's going to take through the Senate. It isn't on the Senate floor yet or the calendar, and I'm certainly not trying to delay it. I'll tell you what, I don't care.
Well, perhaps what we could do is prepare an amendment and reach an agreement before adopt the amendment on the floor.
Madam Chair, I would suggest that amendment be prepared on the floor for item 3, line 7. It says two members of the House of Representatives, two members of the Senate selected by appropriate presiding officers, one of each body being of the minority or something.
I sure. And that being on the Senate floor, I'll probably assure its movement. You usually if you get something, you're going to go along with
See, we don't get
our Kelly's concerns. I don't have any desire to hold it up.
No. We don't get any credit for all the work that you get accomplished up here in the committee, because we have to fight those battles all over again. Well, I'd be prepared to make that amendment on the floor.
I'm prepared to vote for the bill. I'll go for find three more, Ken.
That's your job.
Is there further discussion? What's the will of the committee on the bill?
Madam Chair, I move CS for Senate Bill number 124, J version, out of committee with individual recommendations.
Okay, there's a motion to move the bill with individual recommendations. Senator Sharp, do you expect the task force to operate without fiscal impact? I assume that the utilities will be interested enough, they'll make sure that their people get there.
That was my inclination that the legislative portion be born out of that, and those utilities would provide their own funding.
I suspect, knowing the workload of the commissioners that on 4 and 5, they would probably appreciate if you also said, or a designee as opposed to being forced to be the commissioner, but we could do that on the 4 too.
Okay.
124 has moved. We will now go to teleconference. We do have before Senate Bill 67. It's the Mental Health Trust Amendments Bill. There is a CS being drafted. Apparently our legislative legal drafter and the Department of Law drafter had some preliminary disagreements. I understand that they have been handed to me even as we speak. We do have a draft CS before us. It's version U by Chenoweth, 5593. I know there are teleconference sites that haven't seen the draft. We will have it faxed to those teleconference sites if the ones who are interested will let the bridge know. We'll get them out to you. In the meantime, we've been handed a packet of information that I believe was put together by the Department of Law. It looks certainly bewildering enough to have come from attorneys anyway. And there are a couple of other handouts that we should make sure everybody has a copy of. Steve, you want to pass these around? And we have this draft CS. Senator Frank, would it be your intent to go ahead and offer the work draft?
What I'd like to do is invite the Attorney General to the table. I don't care whether we attempt to adopt it. I think I feel more comfortable in waiting to adopt the CS, the proposed CS, until we've had an opportunity to hear from the Attorney General. I think it would be preferable to, before adopting anything, to hear from the Attorney General on the issue as opposed to adopting the CS first.
Okay, that's fine with me. I'd note for the record, we have been joined by Senator Lehman, also by Representative Davies and also Toohey. Mr. Attorney General, would you please come forward and back to you for your wisdom yet again.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. Would you like initially a summary of the proposed amendments?
Senator Frank?
I would prefer just a little background. Perhaps some of the other committees have heard the latest. I think it would be helpful to have an explanation of the judge's recent decision and some background so that we can understand the context in which the amendments have been offered. Thank you.
Following the enactment of Chapter 66, the attorneys representing the Weiss plaintiffs and the state negotiated a settlement agreement. Negotiation of that agreement took a long time, but we eventually got it done. And it was an agreement of about 50 or 60 pages. that agreement in Chapter 66 was subjected to attack in the court in Fairbanks, where the Weiss proceeding has been pending for several years by a number of parties raising a variety of objections to the validity of Chapter 66. The court, on last week, in a memorandum decision and order filed in the Superior Court in Fairbanks on April 26, so far as is relevant here today, found that it was the legislative intent that the Commissioner of Natural Resources select the lands to be given by the state as security for the performance of the state's obligations under Chapter 66 and the settlement agreement. The court further found, however, that this delegation to select the hypothecated lands to the Commissioner of Natural Resources was unconstitutional because it did not contain the requisite standards required by law to guide the Commissioner in the selection of those lands. The court said, however, that with respect to this infirmity, that the cure was not difficult. And on page 82 of the opinion, in footnote 42, said the following. Obviously, it would be very easy for the legislature to remedy this problem if the legislature amended section 65, paren A, small paren, to adopt a specific known list or delegated the task of preparing a new list with adequate standards, the difficulty would be eliminated. The court said, no more, no less. The court also found that Title 38 was applicable to the process. And as you recall, Title 38 contains provisions governing the planning and classification of state lands. So that is where the parties to the litigation were situated when the court entered its decision on April 26. So, after discussions with the plaintiff's lawyers and attorneys for Department of Law, we decided to propose to the legislature a very easy solution suggested by Judge Green to delegate to the Commissioner of Natural Resources, with adequate standards, the task of selecting the hypothecated lands. And that is what we have done in this proposed legislation. Secondly, with respect to the provisions of the order dealing with Title 38, after discussing this problem not only with attorneys for the Weiss plaintiffs, sometimes called the settling plaintiffs, but with industry people, we provided for a modification of the Title 38 planning and classifications process. We thought that the full provisions of Title 38 dealing with planning and classifications were unduly burdensome and time-consuming, but we also acceded to the views of the industry people that they would want to have a say in how these lands are selected. So there would be an opportunity for the public to have their say and to make their views known with respect to what lands are included in these hypothecated lands. And so we provided that for a notice to be given of the proposed selection and an opportunity for a hearing by people who would be affected by the proposed hypothecation of specific parcels and a requisite of findings to be prepared by the Commissioner of Natural Resources. I want to say, too, and this is very important in my view, after discussion with lawyers for the settling plaintiffs, we agreed that the amount of hypothecated lands would not be 6.7 million acres, but would be 1.5 million acres. That's, I think, a dramatic reduction in the amount of acreage which will be pledged by the state as security for performance of the state's obligations. Furthermore, important to bear in mind in this regard is the fact that as the trust is reconstituted, there is to be a pro rata reduction in the amount of the hypothecated acreage. So, you know, we start with no more than 1.5 million acres under this proposal, and as soon as the trust begins to be reconstituted and the process is underway, there is a reduction in the amount of the hypothecated acreage. I think that generally summarizes, Senator, where we are at this point. And I have a further statement to make, but I would be pleased to respond to questions if there are any at this time.
Questions? Senator Curtula, we're on teleconference. Please use your mic.
Since the Attorney General has been very much involved in this, and undoubtedly DNR Commissioner has to at least consult with them, I rather hope that was the case, presumably it is, they must have some insight into what the 1.5 million acres would be. Okay, they obviously would not be the mountaintops or the helter-skelter remote selections used in some cases to frustrate or screw up any ability to proceed with the way we had attempted earlier. I'm very concerned that they're not located in known and resource-producing areas now, which the state depends on. Its incomes provide for not only the programs of this effort provides for, but also schools and so on. And I'm really concerned that we don't start giving carte blanche an opportunity to take vast resources and turn them in here under the, you know, hey, we got a good deal, we're now down to 1.5 million rather than 6.7. Senator, what can you do to assure me that this isn't what's going on, which I think is going
on? Pardon me? I missed that last.
I just said I think that we have a concern here. Yes.
Thank you, Senator.
Now I get thumped. I don't
know. No, I think it's a very appropriate comment, and I overlooked discussing that subject in my opening remarks. So I'm pleased to have the opportunity now to address that subject. If I may have just a minute.
You know, the last time we left DNR, we ended up with an awful lot of problems that we hadn't intended in a big land settlement, and then a lot of lands left, valuable lands indeed, that were not intended either, at least according to testimony gained during the period of time of the land exchange.
Senator, I have now prepared a response specifically to your question. Thank you for the opportunity to allow me to find the appropriate provisions of the proposed amendment. And they may be found on page 3, beginning at line 14. These are the provisions dealing with the so-called hypothecated mortgage-pledged lands of the proposed committee substitute.
Thank you.
And this section reads as follows. In addition to the land described in section 1 of this subsection, not more than 1,500 or 1,500 1,000 acres of other state land that is identified in an agreement negotiated between the Commissioner of Natural Resources and the plaintiffs in the Weiss litigation. Under this paragraph, the Commissioner of Natural Resources and the plaintiffs in Weiss shall negotiate the agreement for other state land for hypothecation by using the criteria set out in Section 55, Subsection D and E of Chapter 66, SLA 1991, that are applicable to the proposed exchanges of land between the state and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority as authorized by Section 55, Chapter 66, SLA 1991. So then the question becomes, what are those standards? And I want to read them now so that we can perhaps clear up this question which has been troubling you. Subsection D of Section 55 of SLA 1991 says this: exchanges under this section shall involve, as nearly as practicable, land of comparable character. In determining whether land proposed for exchange is of comparable character, the factors to be considered are: 1, terrain; 2, use; 3, location; 4, developmental protection; 5, income potential; 6, accessibility; and 7, other physical characteristics. Then in subsection E, continues as follows: additional factors that shall be considered in determining whether land proposed for exchange ... should be conveyed by the commissioner ... are: 1, ensuring an appropriate diversity in the character of land in the trust corpus and state ownership; 2, additional development and income generating potential as a result of trust ownership; 3, the public interest in retaining specific land in state ownership; 4, public benefits resulting from the exchange; 5, benefits to the trust resulting from the exchange; 6, efficiency in land management resulting from the exchange. Now let me summarize that where we are. Those factors which the legislature saw fit to enact in Chapter 66, dealing with how you try to reconstitute the trust by substitution of comparable lands for the original trust lands, are the same factors to be applied in the selection of the hypothecated lands. That would serve to do two things. One, to prevent the hypothecation of high-priority lands in and of themselves that had no requisite comparability to the original trust land. And it would also serve to mesh the exchange back to the million acres with the hypothecated 1.5 acres. See, so we can serve two purposes by establishing these same standards. I hope that that lengthy answer was enlightening and not confusing.
Chairperson, it's enlightening.
Senator Katuma, please use your microphone. Yeah. I apologize, but you
know. No, I appreciate that. I'm sorry to ask, have you got to remind me. Well, it is enlightening, but it's worrisome. It's worrisome.
Can I follow up on that just a bit?
Thank you.
I want to say that we've had concern expressed by people that this is going to allow the wholesale hypothecation of the Cook Inlet oil lease land. Now let me show you what this million acres in the Cook Inlet area looked like when they were selected. I have this chart here. And the red are the those original mental health lands which are outside of legislatively designated areas at the present time. The blue lines are the mental health lens in the area as legislatively designated areas. Now, from my standpoint, I see nothing in these in Cook Inlet as such that shows the selection of lands which have income producing potential for oil and gas. Now, but let me go on a little bit, because people say, goodness,
beaches and so on.
Well, goodness, here you see lands in Kenai, you see lands in the vicinity of Tioni, and lands in the valley. But what are the consequences? Well, now the Supreme Court directed the state in 1985 to reconstitute the trust. That's 7.5 years ago. And I want to read here what the Supreme Court said, directed by its mandate, the state to do. Quote, those general grant lands which were once mental health lands will return to their former trust status. In the event exchanges have been made, those properties which can be traced to an exchange involving mental health lands will also be included in the trust. That means, you know, if we've exchanged lands with native corporations or municipalities, the court said, put them back into the trust, into the original million acres. The court went on to say, to the extent that former mental health lands have been sold since the date of the conveyance, the trust must be reimbursed for the fair market value at the time of the sale. Lands which have been sold to, I would say, bona fide purchasers, but that's still a little bit in dispute. And the court went on to say, in calculating the total amount owed, the trial court should grant a set-off for mental health expenditures made by the state during the same period. So, where are we at this moment in time, as they say? It's simply this. If Chapter 66 is terminated by the settling plaintiffs, as they have an opportunity to do under the Superior Court's decision, we will proceed to reconstitute the trust as directed by the Alaska Supreme Court in 1985. Now, that's a formidable undertaking. Here's what the Superior Court in Fairbanks said about the task of reconstituting the trust. Quote, the reconstitution of the trust as mandated by the Supreme Court is a Herculean task. It will involve litigation in every judicial district in this state. It will necessitate adjudicating private third-party rights to up to 3,162 parcels of land, involving almost 50,000 acres of land which have been conveyed by the state. It will involve litigation regarding over 83,000 plus acres of land conveyed to municipalities in 888 conveyances. The money, time, and effort spent at reaching a negotiated settlement is not unreasonable. It is a fraction of what it would take to litigate this case. So, where are we? Well, I'd say, at the jumping off point. We could either proceed, stay the course with Chapter 66, or we must proceed to reconstitute the trust. And if the settlement agreement is terminated, the state will obey the mandate of the Alaska Supreme Court and proceed to reconstitute the trust in accordance with the court's instructions.
Well, that may well be the case. It doesn't quite answer it. But a little bit of the Cook Inlet values in those two locations.
Well, Senator, like they say, if we reconstitute the trust as mandated by the Alaska Supreme Court, and this is not any suggestion, this is an order of the court, in some ways 8 years later, I mean, I usually try to comply with the orders of the court, though somewhat less than 10 years or 8 years, but when this is order is 8 years old, and we've tried legislatively 7.5 years to solve this problem, coming along, I think, quite well under Chapter 66. If we walk away from it now, I can't guarantee, but I think I'm close to guaranteeing that these lands will go back. The very lands that are involved. So, it's like I say, in the early days, you know, there was this dentist well known throughout the Northwest. He was called Painless Parker. Got quite a following in those days. But I assure you, there are no Painless Parkers in this mental health dispute. There will be pain by people, mental health people, state, beneficiaries, lessees, no matter what course is taken. My recommendation is to continue to proceed under Chapter 66 and work our way through it. We're on the verge of being able to get this trust largely reconstituted, and I think we should stay the course. Too late in the game now to opt out. And if we do, we're back where we were at least 2 years ago. In fact, we're back where we were nearly 8 years ago. So,
thank you, Chairperson. I know others have important questions. This was one I'll argue it a bit later. You know, DNR in this previous land selection had my minimum high regard, and I would look to having more involvement this time than we had previously.
May I just point out, Madam Chairman, a couple other charts I have dealing with the original trust lands. If we are going to reconstitute the trust, here are the lands in Southeastern. Ketchikan. I'm not much familiar with Ketchikan city, but it looks like that dock for Ketchikan is sort of right smack in the center. Then there's Petersburg. Same appears. A lot of the land around Juneau. Of course, here's the Haines Forest. Then, for those of us who know Fairbanks, you can see where those trust lands were in Fairbanks. So, a sense of what the problem we're dealing with. Supreme Court said address these 888 separate conveyances involving exchanges for lands conveyed to municipalities. Now, I just want to say, as far as the comparability, I can assure you, Senator, the Department of Law will be heavily involved in the selection of those comparables. Lands to be put in not only the hypothecated land list but in the reconstituted land list. And I have some very strong feelings about those put in the lease lands.
Thank you.
Are there other questions for Mr. Cole? Senator Rieger.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just a question back on those maps. Is the area in red, does that mean totally free of legislative designation, or does that mean that there could be an oil and gas lease there but not an actual transfer of title? What does the red really mean?
The red really means those are original metal kelp lands which have not been now placed in legislatively designated.
Is an oil and gas lease or a coal lease or timber contract a legislatively designated area?
No.
Okay. I had one other question. Could you, on the work draft, on the top of page 2, there's a phrase which says, the Alaska Supreme Court may order the Commissioner of Natural Resources to convey appropriate state land to the trust without further legislative authorization. I don't know if that was there before or not. It's the first time I've gotten into this issue. Could you explain what that means and what that effect would be?
That is a provision, Senator Rieger, which is contained in subsection H, section 55 of SLA 1991. It was designed to put an end, as it were, a final adjudication of the comparable land exchanges in the event that the parties working the reconstituting process weren't able to reach agreement. And our view was that the Supreme Court would have the opportunity to appoint a master to make the final reconstitution decisions.
So actually it's just a drafting error that it's shown as bold-faced, generally means new language. It's actually existing language.
I'll tell you what happened there. There is a rule of law which provides that the findings and adjudications of administrative agencies are given deference, to be given deference by the court. The government, in a sense, gets a little bit of benefit of the doubt because presumably they have expertise in the area. And so as we negotiated this particular clause with the plaintiff's lawyers, they said, well, look, we can't go along with anything in which the Commissioner of Natural Resources is an interested party. We'll get the benefit of the doubt from the findings he makes. So we had some harsh words back and forth for about an hour, and we went down and dealt with what this fish landing tax and came back and said, I'll tell you what, make you deal. Why don't we just put in a sentence that says the Supreme Court may not give deference to the findings? And they said they thought they were the same thing, so we said, okay, it's a deal, and put that section in to avoid that dispute.
Yes, one more question.
Go ahead.
It's in your description of the new agreement that you've been working with the plaintiffs on. You mentioned that there would be some kind of a reduction of hypothecated lands as on a pro rata basis as the trust is reconstituted. And I guess I need to be brought up to speed a little bit there too. Is that to say that the hypothecated lands are not actually the mental health trust lands per se?
Yes.
But only still just collateral and internally selected?
Yes.
And during that period that they're hypothecated, what is the treatment of the income of the hypothecated land? Is that stated?
I would like Mr. Custer to answer that question unless I give it. Mr. Custer says that they go into the state general fund.
Okay, so
they're state money.
So they're truly only collateral and not owned in any way by the trust?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Somewhat as though you just granted a deed of trust on some property out there, security for them.
payment of money, but this happens to be the performance of another act.
Any further questions right now for Senator Lehman? Would you please use the microphone?
Attorney General, I'll follow up to that. What is your anticipation of the schedule for the reconstitution of that part of the trust in Section 1, paragraph 1 under Section 5, approximately 500,000 acres? My understanding is those are the easier ones to make the transfer on, but they will first be hypothecated, but they will likely also be the first to be released, which goes through the trust. What's the schedule for that? Is that something we can get?
I'd like Mr. Custer to sit here and answer to that, lest I be in error. Let me point out, Mr. Custer said, Senator Rieger, that there was a drafting error, that other language should not be bolded, that highlighted in the last sentence, in the preceding sentence, which I remarked is the one to be added. Here's a problem.
Madam Chair, the question was, what was the time frame for the return of the unencumbered original mental health trust land to the trust? The necessary title work to prepare the patents, the conveyance documents, and determine which lands fall into which category and so on is being done right now. That's one of the things that we identified early in the process as something that needed to begin immediately if we were to adhere to the time frame that we all had contemplated in Chapter 66. So that work is being done now. If, as we anticipate, these amendments are passed and the Superior Court takes final action on Chapter 66 in the next couple months, we anticipate that the appeal could be heard in as little as 6 to 12 months in the Alaska Supreme Court, leading to the Chapter 66 becoming effective. We would anticipate that virtually at that time, that land would be transferred to the trust.
Senator Rieger.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. Just still trying to figure out this hypothecation a little bit. Why is it that you hear the assertion that hypothecated lands can't be developed? And why is that that we hear that kind of assertion?
There's no flat prohibition on development of hypothecated lands. The concern, however, as with any form of collateral, is that if you take actions that diminish its value, then its value as collateral is also diminished. And that has been the concern, is that whatever activities take place not result in a diminishment of the value as collateral. Here, obviously, if these amendments were to pass and the amount of land hypothecated dropped from 6.7 million to 1.5 million, that in itself would be a dramatic reduction of the amount of land hypothecated, but the standard would still be adequate to reconstitute the trust. And I think it's because we now have 2 years of land work behind us that the plaintiffs were comfortable in saying that yes, 1.5 million acres would be adequate to serve as that collateral.
So what triggers, to continue the metaphor of collateral, what could trigger the parallel? What triggers the foreclosure where hypothecated land becomes part of the trust itself?
Upon a failure of the state to perform its obligations as part of the settlement, that is, to reconstitute the trust as provided in Chapter 66, the Supreme Court would be empowered to foreclose lands that are on hypothecated lands list to the extent the state breached its obligations.
May I follow up on that, Senator? The possibility of the state breaching its obligations under this agreement, once it's approved and ordered by the Superior Court, virtually zero, because the court will order the state to perform under the agreement, and therefore the court certainly would grant specific performance of the reconstitution order. I have argued that this hypothecated lands was really an unnecessary provision of the settlement agreement, but we've never been able to persuade the plaintiff's lawyers to accept it. And, so in order to reach agreement, we agreed to it. But nonetheless, I think, like I say, the possibility of there being
foreclosure under the hypothecated land at zero.
One last follow-up. So, if is the state in, I probably shouldn't ask you this, but is the state in breach of the trust right now? I mean, it seems like that's the status.
Yes.
Okay, so
we
why?
We breached in 1978, and we never cured the breach.
Okay, that's...
You know, 15 years later, and we're still in breach. Okay. We haven't repaid the money, we haven't given the land up.
So, why can't the court tomorrow, if this were to pass, say, you're in breach, we're going to foreclose on this hypothecated land, and that's going to settle the issue?
Well, because the court could proceed, I think, I don't want to make any concessions to the judicial type of commission, the court could take, I think, some strong steps to the state, against the state, for not getting along with the performance of its mandate. But we're not in breach of the settlement agreement, chapter 66 at this time. And so I just, you might say, continue to breach it, essentially deferred by agreement of the 26 lawyers.
May I just add that as long as the state continues in good faith to implement the settlement as provided in Chapter 66, we will not be in breach, and the court would not have the power to foreclose the hypothecated lands. Right now, the court does not have the power to deal with the hypothecated lands. What it does have the power to deal with are the original trust lands. What we're trying to do is to avoid the hardship that would result if the court, in fact, dealt with those original trust lands that we believe, as a matter of policy, ought not to be returned to trust status.
Thank you.
Any other questions at the moment for the Attorney General? Senator Sharp, we are on teleconference.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to get it clear in my mind, on page 3, section 5, line 14, that 1.5 acres has to come out of the previous 6 million that was identified?
Senator, it's a reduction of the...
From 6 to 1.5, but...
From 6.7 to 1.5, but it does not have to be in that tentatively selected hypothecated acreage.
So it's not confined to be selected out of the 6.7 million. It can come from whatever land is agreed upon.
That's right. It's a clean slate of 1.5 million acres.
Thank you.
Other questions? Rip Sandy? That's fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Attorney General, I have three questions. Maybe I'll just ask them very quickly and you could respond to them. One is, why is it that the judge offered two options in remedying the designation? One was to provide standards, the other was to provide a specific list. Why is it that we don't choose the first option? And in a kind of subset of that is, is it possible to get at least a percentage breakdown in the classification of the lands under that list if you can't get the exact list? That's question number one. Number two is, in terms of the legislation that's proposed legislation that's before us here, is it workable to go forward with just the standards portion of it and not the 380405 portion of it? That's question two. And the third question is, you presented us in a fairly bleak circumstance. We're cruising down Route 66 here, and we have two choices in your view, to keep going down there or crash. My third question is there not perhaps an off-ramp, which might be Route 201? And I know that there are many objections to that, but I'm just hypothetically, suppose that there were agreement among the litigants and yourself, would the court accept that route? That's my question.
They respond as follows. With respect to the designation by the legislature of a specific 1.5 million acres, I do not think we have time in the remaining days of this legislative session to select the 1.5 million acres from specifically designated parcels. Secondly, in that regard, I mean, for every parcel, we would have perhaps the owner or an interest group coming to the legislature and saying, don't select this parcel, black acre, select white acre, et cetera, et cetera. And I think we would be in a process which we could not point out. I think that the proposed alternative to have public hearings and allow everyone to come in and have their say is perhaps even better solution to having the legislature to try to do it. And furthermore, there's the form of appellate process there. I think we get it done. That's the answer to that question. Now, if you would be good enough to restate question number two.
In terms of the legislation here, could this proceed with just the standards and not the 380405 remedy?
The answer to that question is yes. I think it would slow down the reconstituted process without an offsetting benefit to all of the parties, including the owners of the people who have specific interests in this election. And bear in mind, this is all state land that we would be hypothecating. But suppose, for example, developers said, well, I'd like this land here, I have some proposed plans for it or something like that, I would like to object to it, and then the process can work, I think, administratively and with the final judicial remedy. Now third, driving down Route 66 in our Model A, which we seem to be doing about that pace, but in any event, the motor is running well and we're making progress. Yes, it's true, as I've said many times, if we were able to reach agreement with all of the parties on the solution to the mental health lands controversy, I suspect, but I'm not certain, that the court would accept it. After all, this is a class action, and class action notice has to be given. The court must issue preliminary approval for class action settlement, and then those affected have an opportunity to register their approval or disapproval. So it's not for sure that agreement among all of the parties would settle the litigation. But it probably would. The problem is we've been absolutely unable to reach agreement with everyone. We have what I call the so-called public interest in put any of these legislatively designated areas back in the trust. We want to keep them in forest lands and preserve them. I understand that. I'm not opposing what they want to do. It's a matter of philosophy. I'm simply saying when you have people who say, we don't want to put those back in, then you have other people who say, put lands in to develop them so we can generate income for the beneficiaries of these mental health programs. How does one ever sit down and get them to all put their names on the same piece of paper? Even among the plaintiffs, even though Mr. Jesse represents a group that disagrees with the settling plaintiff's attorneys. And so we tried to reach a court and we have been unable to do it. Then we get the developmental interests and say, look, don't interfere with this. This is going to interfere with our proposals. But to me, the great mystery is why the developmental people do not want to see this solved, even at the risk of some present pain. In my view, the great thing that we can do for the developmental interests, the resource people, is to get this problem behind us without it lingering on out there for another 5 to possibly 10 years. We've got to get it done. And if we fall off or get bucked off here, we're back to square one where we were in 84. And I leave it, to the legislature to make that call.
Can we have a quick follow-up?
Yes, you can.
We had Senate Bill 67 in its previous incarnation, which is comparable to House Bill 201. Moving through a number of committees, has there been? I'm not party to some of the negotiations that have been going on, but I'm asking genuinely, has there been serious attempt at negotiating a settlement along those lines?
Yes. Let me say this. I put it this way. People say, why does the administration object to those proposed solutions? And let me tell you the reason. And I put it in terms of this illustration. Suppose you were given in trust for your children's education 1,000 acres of land, and you hold that as trustee and collect the income and so forth for the benefit of your children's education. And about 5 years out, you go up on a toot and say, well, you know, I think I can raise a quick buck to cure my debts that I got down in Las Vegas, and I think I'll just sell 500 of those 1,000 acres and pay off my gambling debts and so forth, and I'll make it that way. And so, but you can make it up later, and so you wind up with 500 acres, and 500 acres are missing. So your children become of age, they hire some ambulance-chasing lawyers and file suit. Say, hey, you know, you have breached trust obligations, and you know, you got to make it good. You confess, as the state has done here, you confess, say yes, you know, it's a time of ill judgment, 1978, and I want to make it good. And I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll put back the 500 acres which I own, put it back in the trust, and I'll pay you for the value of the 500 missing acres. And, you know, interest on the funds. And you think that's a pretty fair settlement. But the lawyer, you know, he says, no, I want you to put back the 500 acres, but I want 10% of your earnings for the rest of your life, and your children's earnings for the rest of their life, and your children's children forever. And, you know, you say, hey, wait a minute. I mean, all I have to do is make the trust whole. You know, cure my grief by making the trust whole. And they say, isn't it good enough? We want 6% of the state's unrestricted or whatever it is, general revenues forever. And the administration says, no, it's unfair. Much. We will make the trust whole by land, money, combination. But we won't pay and pay. Pay. And so what the theory of this current Chapter 66 is, you know, we will put back original land which we still have, and we will put back as much land as we can get comparability, and see where we are. It's a long answer, but that's the trouble that we, the administration sees over those two proposals.
Thank you. You're not suggesting the legislature went off on a toot in 78, are you?
I asked Admiral Bruce what happened in 78, you know, and he said, Charlie, just as well you don't ask me that question. So I didn't. My good friend Admiral Bruce.
Any other questions for the Attorney General? Okay, Mr. Attorney General, if you'd like to stay with us at the table, that would be great. We do have a number of people online, plus people here in Juneau who are interested in testifying, and let's see. First, I want to take the plaintiffs themselves. Let's take David Walker here in Juneau, and then we'll go to Jim Gottstein in the Anchorage. Mr. Gottstein, if you'd please be ready. And I'd like to try to keep the testimony as short as possible, preferably no more than 5 minutes, so we can get as many people in as possible today. At least we don't have to go back through the whole history again.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Walker. I represent Vern Weiss and the Borough Pellicer. Vern is father and next friend of Carl Weiss. They're class representatives, so they represent themselves and others similarly situated. I have taken on the role as lead counsel for the now settling plaintiffs, that is, those plaintiffs who continue to support the settlement agreement based upon Chapter 66 which the legislature passed, and the settlement agreement, which was subsequently entered by the state and the settlement claimants. The place that the legislature and the parties find themselves in today is this. On May the 26th, after April 26th, the court has provided a ruling which is in most aspects very favorable to the settlement and to the parties who support the settlement. The court identified two difficulties with the settlement and suggested that there were ways that the legislature could easily fix it. I think that my purpose in testifying today should be to tell you that the settling plaintiffs continue very strongly to support the settlement. We believe that it is in the best interest of the beneficiaries and in the best interest of the state as a whole to go forward with it. And so it's worth protecting. It's worth protecting because at the end of the settlement envisioned by Chapter 66, that you all passed in the settlement agreement, we will end up with being made whole. We will end up with an order from the Superior Court that says that the trust has been fully reconstituted based upon the criteria which Attorney General Cole went over with you, and that the exchanges will have been based on full fair market value exchanges. That's basically not as much as the beneficiaries would like. It's not as much as they need, but I feel that in the reconstitution portions of the trust, that's what we're entitled to receive. And so we continue to support it. We believe that it's certainly worthwhile for the legislature to address those two defects in the proposal that Judge Green identified. I won't, especially because you've asked that I be brief, and I'm not prepared to go through all the other parts of her opinion, which she ruled favorably for us on, but I assure you that they're substantial and include most of the issues that seem most troublesome to this legislature in effect. So we support fixing the defects in the settlement and in Chapter 66 that have been identified by Judge Green. I have only at this hearing had the channel of draft view, and I have seen a draft that received that for less, had that for less than 1 hour. So, you know, I have listened to the Attorney General's presentation and feel that that he has said nothing that I identify that I disagree with, and I do support the settlement, and I do support fixing the defects in 66 identified by Judge Green.
Thank you. Senator Rieger.
So the change to the $1.5 million is something that you entered into some kind of an informal or formal agreement with the Attorney General?
Well, the substance of that is before you. It's we believe that first of all, I don't want to get too far aside, but recognize that the several million acres of hypothecated land that we're talking about today is hypothecated under Chapter 66. And so that list, that hypothecation of that land was fully approved by the state, by the governor, by the attorney general, and by the seven plaintiffs. So there's not a question about whether that, what was intended. Judge Green has said there is a failure in that hypothecation that can be cured easily. And we have seen that the continuing discussions about the hypothecation have been a bar to going forward with the settlement. And during that time, though, both our staff and the DNR staff have worked to try and move forward to implement 66. So we know a lot more about the lands that are involved, about the original trust lands, about lands that are available for inclusion into the trust. And so the 1.5 million acre application is something that we've been involved in, looked at, and do accept in the context of this.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, sir. We do appreciate you keeping it brief. Mr. Gottstein, and after Mr. Gottstein, we'll take Mr. Jesse, who I understand has dialed in.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ken Gottstein. I represent the Elias Mental Health Association, Mary C. Hanaway, and John Martin on behalf of themselves and all others similarly situated in this mental health trust land litigation. In terms of the beneficiary
cut off due to a power failure here. If you could please continue.
Thank you. Where was I?
Right after he said he was the lead land person.
You were still explaining, well, you had just finished saying that you were here to answer any questions, but then you also began to talk a little more.
Okay, well, the main point that I was trying to make is that both of the provisions regarding hypothecated lands and the application of 3804 and 05 were integral elements of the agreement that we reached in 1991, and that the settlement agreement provides that if the court rules either of those things invalid, that the plaintiffs have the option of terminating the settlement agreement. And so, because essentially of drafting errors in 1991, the Supreme Court identified these two particular areas that need correcting, and I think that's what the Attorney General is going to be done. I don't think I need to say anything more, but I've said it before. I'm available to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gottstein. Senator Rieger has a question.
Thank you. Real briefly, two questions. One, are you also one of the settling parties that has agreed on the 1.5 million acre figure?
Yes. It's important to recognize where we are in this thing, which is that we're attorneys representing our clients, and we can recommend certain things to our clients for approval. I actually did meet with the president and liaison of the and asked them about this particular issue yesterday, and they offered me to go forward with this.
Thank you. And one other question that I'm not asking for a long answer. Could you very briefly explain, when you state that you are the lead land person, what management control do you have the ability to exercise on hypothecated land?
Basically, we have no authority at all. The agreement provides that the state shall not take any action that substantially devalues the hypothecated lands for trust ownership. We are given notice of any actions. They tend to listen to our comments, but if we object anything, they might close our own recourse into the courts.
So you have a veto power in a way, but not any other management power?
We definitely do not have a veto power at all. They give us notice, but the rule is that they cannot substantially devalue the land for trust ownership. But we don't get to make that determination. The department does. If we felt extremely aggrieved by that, we could seek correction from the court, just as many other parties could seek correction if they felt that the Department of Natural Resources violated. No, we do not have a veto at all.
Just one last, I'm sorry, I said the last one would be the last, but do you have any notion of what the 1.5 million acres would contain, or is that still wide open in your view?
Well, we're going to have to try to work that out with the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources and the Attorney General.
There are no preliminary discussions that are indicating what they would be?
We haven't had a chance to talk about that.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Gottstein? Thank you very much, Jim. Now we'll go to Mr. Jesse.
Yes, Madam Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I am the senior attorney with Advocacy Services of Alaska, and I represent primarily people with developmental disabilities who are part of the beneficiaries of the trust. And in 1991,
computers.
Yeah,
check your computer.
there's obviously an attempt to say that all one needs to do is simply make these purportedly easy fixes, and we'll be well on our way to getting Chapter 66 underway. Well, certainly many people wish that that were true, but unfortunately it is not. There is currently pending in the Superior Court oral argument between Marathon and Unitel oil companies and the state of the settling plaintiffs concerning both the ability of the state to transfer the oil company leases to the trust as potentially contemplated under Chapter 67, and also the validity of the settlement agreement itself, since there has been management authority taken by DNR and the settling plaintiffs pursuant to the settlement agreement, but before the effective date of Chapter 66. In addition, I'd like to point out that there is currently an ongoing dispute between the settling plaintiffs and the state regarding the terms of the actual settlement agreement. It has been the settling plaintiff's position that, and certainly with my understanding when I was a settling plaintiff, that under the terms of the agreement, settling plaintiffs would be entitled to nominate any state land as proposed substitute land, which was not currently in a legislatively designated area, and that the state would then close that land to mineral entry and segregate it from disposal. In February of this year, the state notified the settling plaintiffs that that was not their understanding of the settlement agreement, that they did not believe that absent the approval of those proposed substitute lands, would the state fulfill their obligation under the settlement agreement. This dispute has not yet been litigated. However, it is certainly my belief that it must be litigated before the court would be able to give even preliminary approval to Chapter 66. These are just two of the other concerns that you need to consider in seeing whether you feel these are the easy, simple fixes that they are presented to you as. Now, sure that there is no attempt on the part of the legislature to have second thoughts as they face the outpouring of concern and objection from the public when we actually get to the point of putting these lands back into the trust. I point that out as well. One of the things that we've learned is that, well, we can't have the list, either because it doesn't exist yet, or, as the Attorney General suggested, if we were to give you the list, there would be so many objections to the lands that were to be hypothecated that it would be politically not viable to pass such a list. Well, I suggest that if it's that painful and difficult to contemplate what lands may be put on a list as security, imagine, if you will, what will happen when the kinds of lands that I mentioned before are finally submitted to Supreme Court or Master and are forced into the trust against the people's will. When we talk about the management of hypothecation, lands that are in hypothecation, one thing that the Attorney General mentioned, perhaps in a draft of the bill that I don't have, is I do not understand that there is any public comment to be had on what lands are to be placed in hypothecation. Perhaps that's something that he could clear up for us. I would like to make one thing very clear, that during the 2 years or year and a half that I was settling plaintiffs, one thing I remember very clearly Mr. Gottstein telling me, and in fact testifying in front of the Superior Court in Fairbanks, was that we in fact did need Cook Inlet oil and gas leases or some other major revenue-producing asset in order to fully make whole the trust as it was when it was originally created. It is very disturbing to me to hear the Attorney General say that the state certainly does not believe that that is necessary, as he says has a very strong position on that, and yet David Walker continues to believe that he heard nothing from the Attorney General to which he would not agree. I'd like to close in trying to keep this brief by referring again back to the Attorney General's analogy of why the administration opposes an income stream approach to settling the mental health land trust case. If you recall, his analogy was a person who had land in trust had gone on a tube and somehow conveyed some of it away. And the suggestion was that rather than paying full value for it, that he provide some sort of ongoing income stream. Well, in my mind, this is no different than an individual who's a trustee who has that child at home and fully intends to provide food, shelter, clothing, in any event. And then a realization comes to the people negotiating a settlement that for that individual to pay some huge sum of cash or convey extremely valuable assets as compensation for the breach would impoverish all of the parties. Certainly the ability of that person to provide food, shelter, and clothing to the ward when faced with the cost of making the trust whole could in fact work to the detriment of all. One of the things we suggest to this alternative settlement is that we fully realize the state intends to and will in fact provide food, clothing, shelter, treatment, residential services, inpatient services to people who experience mental disability. Our suggestion is that we work with that reality and try to craft some solution which will enable the state to pay adequate compensation while not impoverishing both itself and indirectly the beneficiary. Finally, I'd like to conclude by stating that it's most unfortunate that you are in fact placed in a position where, due to time constraints and the lack of the ability to have hearings on SB 67 in the past, that you are faced with a crossroads. We have an amendment before you which admittedly still contains drafting errors at this point in time. My suggestion to you is that realizing that time is short, that the decisions here are of an increasingly complex and very important magnitude, that you look at these so-called simple amendments with a very jaundiced eye and realize
Attorney General wish to respond in any fashion?
Yes. Keep my response brief. First, we have eliminated the provision referred to by Mr. Jesse about comparable income producing lands. He does not have the latest version. That provision was unacceptable to the state, and so it's not in the proposed amendments.
I stand corrected, Mr. Attorney General, and I would raise for the committee's consideration that given that, to my knowledge, Mr. Gosky and Mr. Walker have not discussed these proposed amendments outside of portions of their main plaintiff, that this will be an issue of considerable dispute among the beneficiaries, because certainly the intent of the hypothecated security lands was in fact to secure security for land, which would produce as much income as the original trust. That, after all, was the entire purpose of creating the trust at all.
Did you want to comment further before I continue?
No, Mr. Attorney General.
Thank you. All those various concerns are involved in the comparability provision. And as I said earlier, this is not going to be a painless process of reconstituting this trust or getting it back together. I mean, the question is, what is the least painful solution to this historical problem? We do not agree with the settlement plaintiffs on many of their land selections, and we intend to object to them. We intend to do battle if necessary, administratively and in the courts, in order to preserve the integrity of the state's interest in the reconstitution process. We're not going to roll over. We're not going to say you can have these cook in the oil leases. And if you basically look at the income-producing potential of the 1956 land selections, whatever the date the selections were made, and translate them into their income-producing potential today, I guarantee you, you will not find $130 or $140 million of income per year off those lands. You just won't. So we're not going to agree with those things. I want to assure you of that. But we do have problems. Where do you find comparable lands? To downtown Ketchikan? Choice is, do your best to find comparable lands or give them back downtown Ketchikan land. But nobody wants to do that. So, we just have to address this problem and solve it. And as I say, it's not going to be painless. But I, with respect to the oil companies, I have not heard Marathon here testifying in opposition to these amendments. And I've not heard Unocal testifying in opposition to these amendments. If they want to appear and testify in response, we'd be pleased to hear what they have to say. That's all. Thank you.
It is my intention to allow the attorney for Marathon and Unocal to testify. I did want to go first to Mr. Waldo here, that has apparently represents the public interest plaintiffs, or interveners, I should say, and then I was intending to go to Mr. Massoon, or however you pronounce the name, that does represent the other, one of the other interveners, Marathon and Unocal. So, Mr. Waldo, would you like to join us?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Waldo. I'm attorney for the public interest interveners in the mental health litigation. I'm attorney for the public interest interveners in the mental health litigation. The public interest interveners are a coalition of five environmental groups, two sport fishing organizations, and the Susitna Valley Association, which advocates the tourism and recreational values of the Susitna Valley. Collectively, these groups have thousands of Alaskans within their membership that are concerned about the management and use of